The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
If I could pick a mitzvah, commandment, obligation, opportunity, which most represents people's fascination with, misperception of, and I think even abhorrence of sometimes, the ritual aspect of Judaism, it would probably be kashrut. And it seems to me, as with many things, that there are certain obstacles which prevent us from developing a relationship with a given mitzvah, and thus ultimately with the entire Torah, and therefore with God. And I think that this is an example par excellence. And there are certain perceptions that we have of kashrut, questions, which make it difficult for us to deal with these issues. So first of all, we have to define the word kashrut. What does the word kasher mean, kosher? The word kasher, which is very much related to the word mukhshar in modern Hebrew, talented, has more to do with able, with openness, with something being worthy or prepared or in the proper state or framework to be used for a particular purpose. I'll give you an example. In order to make wood, which is mukhshar to be used as furniture, right, which is prepared and ready to be used as furniture, I have to put it through all sorts of processes. And those processes can involve planing and shaving and cutting and lacquering and whatever else it might be. And that wood vis-a-vis the furniture is not kosher until I do that particular activity. We have the concept of purity and impurity. Sometimes an object can simply not be mukhshar lekabel tuma. It isn't worthy or ready to receive impurity. For example, if somehow there is the potential for impurity in rain, in water, and if, for example, I leave my fruit up on the roof to dry and it gets wet, it becomes somehow impure. That same fruit doesn't become impure when the rain falls on it, when it's on the tree. Because as long as it's growing on the tree, as long as it's still related to its original natural state, before man gets involved, it does not yet have the potential to accept impurity. Somehow my involvement in the world of nature creates or allows for the potential for impurity, whatever that means. And I find this in various instances. So for example, if a piece of meat is to be thought of as kosher, let's say, there are certain processes that allow me to make it kosher. So everybody automatically assumes, what is kosher meat and what is unkosher meat? Well, give me a classic example of unkosher meat. Pig, right? Pig is not kosher. There's no way that pig meat could be made edible for me vis-a-vis the laws of kashrut. Give me an example of kosher meat. Brisket, cow meat. Except that that's really incorrect. Because cow meat in and of itself is not kosher. As a matter of fact, if I take a cow, right, and I rip off a chunk of it and start to eat it, not only am I not eating kosher meat, but I'm violating far more than just one transgression. Because the animal hasn't been slaughtered. And it's only the act of ritual slaughter, whatever that means, that allows me to eat the animal. So the word kasher means something is edible, it's prepared, it's ready and allowable and open to accepting the possibility of my eating it. Now, it's worth, just as an aside, noting that there are different categories of kashrut. Some of them are more obvious and some of them are less known. First of all, in the Bible, there are certain animals which are described as being inherently unkosher animals. Right? They can't be edible, let's say, to a Jew who lives by the system of traditional Torah. Right? So a pig, an ostrich, giraffe, you know, many different animals. And then there are animals which are kosher, or at least have the potential to be made kosher, such as a cow or a calf or whatever it might be. Then I have all sorts of other items which can or can't be kosher. For example, fruit. If I take a fruit tree and I plant it, And the first year that the fruit grows, there's a halakha known as orla. And orla means that the first 3 years that fruit grow, I don't eat of it. And only in the fourth year do I take of that fruit up to Jerusalem and eat it there. Netaravai. And then in the fifth year, I finally have kosher fruit on that tree. So we don't normally think of fruit as kosher or non-kosher. And while it may be true that there is no inherently unkosher fruit, all vegetables and all fruit inherently can be kosher, there are certain processes which apply even to the vegetable world and even to the fruit world. Right? Truma and tithing. Taking tithes for the priest. If I have a field and I haven't given the proper amount either to the priest or in certain instances to charity, I can't eat of the whole field. There's a beautiful halakha. It's called pe'ah. Pe'ah literally means a corner, right? For example, I put tzitzit on pe'at bigdecha, right? On the corner of my garment. There's a tradition not to shave pe'at ziknecha or zkancha, the corner of your beard, right? That's why you'll see a lot of religious Jews who don't rely on the leniency of using an electric shaver having beards. So there's a halakha of the pe'ah, the corner of a field. A corner, certain size, of every field has to be left aside for the poor. And if I haven't set aside that corner for the poor, then the whole field is inedible. It's unkosher. I can't eat of it. I can't partake of it. And there are all sorts of different categories of kashrut. I have even categories of items which are inherently kosher and which are kosher in terms of the fact that they are actually edible on their own. And yet, as soon as they become mixtures, they're inedible. Now the most obvious of this is milk and meat. Right? And we'll have to get to that. But there are other less obvious instances. For example, pardon? Well, now we're getting into rabbinics and biblical, so I'm not going to get into it. That's an interesting question, but even in terms of Doraita, right? Pardon?
Cotton and linen.
Cotton and linen. There you go. There are clothings. Very good. There are clothings which are unkosher for me to wear. If I take a perfectly good wool garment, I can wear it. If I take a perfectly good linen garment, I can wear it. There's a biblical prohibition against wearing a garment which is made, now how you define that is very difficult, of wool and linen. So with your background in mitzvot, as we've discussed it, you can imagine that that's a very strange halacha. I mean, what's the difference what I wear? So you'd have to analyze, if you were looking at it from a symbolic perspective, what does wool represent? What does linen represent? Perhaps linen is the most processed material, and wool is the rawest. You take wool right off the sheep and you can practically wear it. And the mixture of these two belies something. Or you could look at it from an ethical perspective. Do I think about the processes as I wear them? Or from a mystical perspective. So we're not going to get into wool and linen, but you see that mixtures also can affect my ability to partake, even if separately items are perfectly acceptable. And then of course you have instances where the vessels that hold given food items become problematic. For example, there's a verse in the Torah that speaks of clay Midian. You're not allowed to use the vessels of the Midianites. And the Talmud explains, and this is biblical, that a vessel which was used for idolatry can't be used by a Jew for any purpose. Matter of fact, if you find it in your house, you have to break it, you have to get rid of it, whatever it might be. Right? So this is a fascinating idea. I make, you know what, the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes cholent. Right? I mean, you could imagine if you're eating Lubavitcher Rebbe cholent, it's probably kosher. Right? But he happened to make it in a pot which was 500 years old. And 500 years ago, or 1500 years ago, or 2500 years ago, this pot was once used in a ceremony of idolatry. And let's say a Kabbalist, a great Kabbalist, Rav Ephraim Kaduri, happens to come by and visit his house, right? Which would be difficult today, but let's say 5 years ago, right? And sees him cooking in the chillin pot, and mystically perceives that 2500 years ago this pot was used for idolatry, right? So they have to throw out the chillin. Not because there's anything wrong with the chillin, but because somehow the pot renders the chillant unedible. So you can imagine that there's an ethical perspective and a symbolic perspective and a mystical perspective, but there are different categories of kashrut. And it's important to note these different categories. Then, by the way, there are also prohibited parts of otherwise permitted animals. Can everybody give me an example? Right. The fat, chalev, of a kosher animal is forbidden, biblically, traditionally. And the fat is usually the area around the tail and of the tail. We won't get into exactly what that is. Excellent. The sciatic nerve. Right? There's a certain nerve in the body of a cow. It's interesting, but, maybe we'll get to that. That's forbidden even though the animal is kosher. Right? And so I find that there are certain parts of animals sometimes which I can't use. And then, of course, there are issues regarding the techniques that were used to make a given animal kosher. For example, if I slaughter an animal incorrectly, or the knife isn't sharp enough, or I use the force of my hand instead of the sharpness of the knife, when you ritually slaughter an animal, you're not supposed to be dores, you're not supposed to push the knife through the neck. The knife is supposed to be so sharp that all you have to do is slide it across the neck and it just slices right through. So if I'm using my own power, the power of my hand to kill the animal, so then the slaughter is no good. If I find a nick in the knife, even the slightest nick, so the slaughter is no good. So the animal is perfectly good. And the animal is kosher. And ostensibly you look at two different dead animals and you don't seem to see the difference. But somehow there's some technical detail which renders the animal unkosher. Right? Those are the basic forms of kashrut. And I'll go through them again. I have permitted and prohibited animals. I have prohibited parts of otherwise permitted animals. I have circumstances which make permitted animals forbidden, right? Including the method of slaughtering. I have prohibited food combinations of what might otherwise be kosher products. I have proportions of mixtures of prohibited foodstuffs, you know, like a 60th or whatever it might be, we'll get to that. And then I have vessels or utensils that are, that affect the food in which they're stored. Now, having said all this, yeah.
What about if an animal was found to be ill or diseased?
Right. In other words, that actually is an animal, which is inherently unkosher. That's called trefa. Right? If an animal is walking around, if somebody is driving a car down a highway, and they happen to be testing their buzzsaw, and they're riding down the highway with their buzzsaw hanging out the window, and a cow runs by, and they just happen to chop off the four legs, right? And I'm walking by the road, and I see, ooh, someone just chopped four legs, lo aleinu, off the animal, so I know it's going to die, so I quickly whip out my samurai slaughtering knife, and ritually slaughter the animal before it can die, because you can't slaughter a dead animal, that's the whole point. The animal's still unkosher, because once the four legs are chopped off and the arteries are all open, so the animal is going to die anyway. So the animal doesn't die vis-a-vis my slaughter. Okay, so that's true. So that's also part of, okay. I mean, you have to realize these are major categories, there are many subcategories. I have to make one disclaimer before we get into this. And that is that I want it to be very, very clear that no one should walk away from this classroom with even the remotest perception of any halachic ruling. Because if I could pick one area of Jewish law which is most complex and which I know personally caused me the most difficulty in trying to understand and still trying to understand, it is the area of kashrut. Very, very complex. It would be impossible for me to accurately portray any halachic detail in less than a week of classes. And so therefore, you know, you may have an idea of a question, but you shouldn't walk away assuming that you have a perception of a halachic conclusion. Now, it seems to me, now that we've got an idea of what kashrut is and what the categories are, that there are certain questions regarding kashrut which are important enough that they affect our ability to relate to this mitzvah. And I can think of three. The first is why an animal should be inherently unkosher. Why is it that a cow by nature is kosher and a pig by nature is not? I mean, what did the rabbis have against that little piggy? You know, I remember we were in Camp Moshava for the summer in Pennsylvania, and we took our kids to like this, you know, petting farm. Magnificent, magnificent place. And, you know, they had like a reptile farm, and they had, snakes and bugs. You know, Yonatan was into the bugs and the snakes. And they had like a barn. And you could go in the barn, you could see all these animals. So I'm standing at the edge holding Yonatan and showing him the horse. And all of a sudden I hear this cry of disgust from my daughter, who's inside the barn. Ah! Right? So I thought, uh-oh, she must have stepped in something, right? Barn, right? Natural thought. So I run inside to save my daughter from whatever potential havoc is in there. She's standing outside this pen, and she's looking at this pig. And she looks at me, and she'd never seen a live pig before. You know, I don't keep them around the house, you know. So she's looking at this pig. Of course, she knows it's a pig, because, you know, we've read her old McDonald and whatever else. And, you know, she knows it goes oink, oink, and whatever else it is, right? I'm not from the nature of those people who believe that I don't want to expose my daughter to pigs in children's stories because it'll somehow spiritually pollute them, right? So she knows what a pig is. So she's standing outside, right? And she's just, Abba, this is gross, right? And I look at this pig, and, you know, granted, gross is a relative term, but I can understand where she's coming from. There's this animal, and it's lying in its own feces, and rolling around in the mud, right? And it's just disgusting. I grant you, relative, grant you, you know, subjective perception, disgusting animal. And she goes, it's disgusting. So I pick her up and dust her off a little and sort of take a step back to make sure I don't faint, right? And, you know, we start talking about this. And, you know, my initial thought is, okay, well, you know, this is a pig. And she looks at me and she's, I don't know, four, and she says, that's why we don't eat pigs, right? Well, except that there's one little problem with that perception. Because if you've ever really taken a close look at a cow, you're not really that much better off. I worked in a refet, in a dairy farm on a kibbutz one summer, milking cows. And, you know, the kibbutzniks, they all love to have fun with the city boys, especially the Americans who come, right? And they sit you down on a stool. Now they have automatic milking machines, whatever. But in certain instances, either on Shabbat or whatever it might be, you have to actually start the process, right? You know, you load this udder up to the tube, whatever. And there is a typical expression that the new American volunteer has as he sits on this stool and performs this activity to create milk, or at least to allow people to have milk, which is something remotely similar to, right? It was disgusting. And you wear these boots, and you have to wade through, like, you know, 12 inches of feces just to get to the cows. And the flies are unbelievable. I mean, if people would spend an afternoon in a dairy farm, they'd never drink milk again. So what is the difference between a cow and a pig? Why should a pig be inherently unkosher? And by the way, go a stage further. Why is the Torah so preoccupied with what I eat? I mean, isn't what really is important not what goes into my mouth, but what comes out of my mouth? Right? And I want to understand this. Because the Torah seems to attach tremendous significance to me eating the right type of thing. And I can't imagine that I, as an ethical person, am affected and that I become a better person because I choose to have a hamburger and I choose not to have a pig burger. So, okay. Now, go a stage further. Take, for example, those animals that are inherently kosher, or at least have the potential to be kosher with proper slaughter or whatever else it is. So, what makes an animal kosher? I'm in the desert, and some strange animal wanders by, and I don't know if it's kosher or not kosher, but I want to eat. So, putting aside the fact that if you're, you know, I'm just stuck. I'm not, my life isn't in danger, right? So what do I have to check? Does anybody know? There are certain signs that will tell me, for example, that an animal is or isn't kosher. The Torah tells me that there are two simanim. One is mafreset parsa, that an animal has cloven hooves. And the other is shosat shesa, that it chews its cud. I want to understand what it means to chew your cud. This means that an animal eats its food, and then the digestive system regurgitates it, and it eats it again. So what is my goal? My goal is that if I'm going to eat meat, I should become more spiritual and more holy, and I should eat from an animal that eats its own vomit. I mean, I don't get it. This is not really high on my list of holy activities. What does this have to do with me as a human being? I'm up there at Sinai, me and God, and I want to develop a relationship, then I'm talking Shabbat, and the candles are lit, and it's incredible, and I have to eat an animal that eats its own vomit. I don't get it. And never mind cloven hooves. So you come into the barn, you're not sure, is the pig kosher or not kosher? So what do you pick up? You pick up its hoof to see if it's split. And what is that? And I want you to know, don't ever try to pick up a cow's hoof. It won't work. First of all, you can't see it unless you pick it up. Second of all, you have to make sure when you finish picking it up, you wash your hands. Right? I remember when I was in this dairy farm, I was nervous of one thing, because I'd seen, you know, a couple of cartoons. What was I nervous? What are you nervous? You're sitting at this little stool, whatever, right? And they sort of, the cows come in, basically inside this fenced row, right? And they stop at a certain area, and you gotta grab their udder, and you gotta attach it to this attachment, this tube, whatever it is, right? And there's flies, and there's, you know, whatever it might be. And once the attachment attaches, yeah, right? You know, have a nice cup of milk with your coffee. And once this attachment is stuck on to the cow's udder, right? So then, it creates a vacuum, and it sucks the milk out of the udder. And by the way, just as an aside, there's an interesting halachic question, before automatic milking machines, which are now used on religious kibbutzim, were developed, could you milk a cow on Shabbat? One of the 39 categories of Shabbat, we spoke about Shabbat, is dash, is removing something from its natural environment, right? There's a certain productive process in this. And so if I take an udder and I squeeze it and I bring the milk out, I'm involved in that productive process, right? And I can't do that on Shabbat. However, if a cow isn't milked and its udders bloat, it causes tremendous suffering to the cows. Now this only became an issue in Israel in the late 1800s and early 1900s because Jews didn't have cows in the Middle Ages. They weren't allowed to own land. They certainly didn't have farms. It wasn't a big issue. It was one of the questions that arose with the modern return to the land of Israel. And the Chazon Ish, famous responsum, one of the greatest rabbis of the last generation, Yeshayahu Karlitz, lived in Bnei Brak. He ruled halachically that not only can you milk cows, but you have an obligation to milk cows to prevent suffering to animals. In other words, we're used to thinking about not violating the Shabbat unless it threatens human life. Here you have an instance where transgressing Shabbat was permitted, not just because it affected animal life, but just animal suffering. So, you know, we often miss the boat on these issues. When you get a picture of halachic response, studying a responsum, you know, questions and answers of the great rabbis is a tremendous tool to becoming sensitive to the beauty that can be found in halacha. But in any event, what is this? What are these symbols? And I remember when I would sit on the stool, so my biggest fear was that the animal would kick me. I mean, everybody saw a little cartoon here or there, Bugs Bunny or Wile E. Coyote with a donkey kicks, right? So I'm waiting for this, and I want to tell you, a cow, big. Very, very big. You do not want to get kicked by a cow. So I was assured by the kibbutz, thinking, no, you don't have to worry, cows don't kick. They don't. They just don't do it. They come, they stand, that's it. Glumpers, right? We're not talking about a highly intelligent species, right? So what is this? The cloven hooves, the udders, the cud chewing. How does that relate to me and my attempt to establish a relationship with God and to become a better human being? And maybe the last question, which is really interesting, is the question of milk and meat. I mean, you take perfectly good, and I'll give you the best example I can think of, which always comes to my mind whenever I discuss this. You take perfectly kosher milk and perfectly kosher meat, right? You know, there are different categories of kashrut. And they're also different, you know, there's a concept in Judaism, lachmir, to be stringent. And we have a problem today, lachmir, a chumrah, stringency, that I call chumrahitis. People have become sometimes so obsessed with finding stringencies that they can apply, that they kind of lose sight of the ultimate goal. That's an interesting dilemma that we have today, especially in the religious, however you want to define that community. But it's interesting to note that there are, in fact, different levels in terms of how much one is willing to be stringent upon oneself. And there's a halacha known as glatt. I don't know if you've ever heard this term, glatt kosher. What does glatt kosher mean? This is fascinating, right? One of the categories of kashrut, as Ivan pointed out, is that if an animal is treif, if an animal is assumed, let's say, to already be dying, lost a limb, or its neck is cut open, or whatever it might be, so the animal is not kosher because the animal has to die as a result of the ritual slaughter, and not as a result of whatever wound it has. Now, there are external wounds, and there are internal wounds. So, for example, suppose that an animal has something wrong with its kidneys. Well, if I were to know this and understand that therefore the animal was going to die, that animal would be treif. So the question is, do I have an obligation to check? In other words, after I've slaughtered the animal, should I perform an autopsy and see whether there are any deficiencies physically, medically in the animal, which really mean that the animal would have died anyway? And the halacha is very clear. The answer is no. I don't have to check. I don't have to assume that an animal has heart congestive failure or that its valve is clogged or anything else. But there are certain areas where this question arose with some more frequency. And one such example is an animal's lungs, a cow's lungs. A cow has very big lungs. And because it has such big lungs, so there can be perforations in the lungs, which won't go noticed for quite a while. But if an animal has a perforated lung, then in fact the animal is unkosher. Because a perforation in a lung is viewed to be something which affects the health of the animal, and therefore there is the risk that the animal is not dying as a result of the slaughter. I'm oversimplifying a very complex issue, right? Fine. So the question is, do I have to check the cow's lungs? And this is the halacha of glat. Glat means smooth, I think. Do I have to ensure that the lungs of the cow are smooth after I ritually slaughter it, right? You can't obviously open up a cow and check its lungs before you slaughter it, because then it's unkosher and you can't slaughter it anymore, so that'd be kind of dumb. So, you know, it could be, I actually once read an interesting responsum. This gets back to Rabbi Cardoza's lecture last week about the people who get into the nitty-gritty and how we look at this, but there's a beauty to it. Now that we have all sorts of medical techniques, you know, arthroscopies and laser cameras, should we do this with cow? We can check a cow's lungs before it dies and all sorts of things. But Baruch Hashem, no major posek has viewed this with any positive attitude, right? However, do I have to check these lungs? And there were a whole vent of rabbis who said that, in fact, one should check these lungs. Now, this is not an obligation. And, in fact, if you don't check the lungs of a cow, you can rely on chazakah, on the assumption. I believe we once spoke about chazakah, right? About the issue of assumption in halacha, right? And I can assume that an animal is kosher. I don't have to assume it's not kosher. But if I find that a lung is perforated, if I happen to come across it, then I have to put that animal aside and realize that it's all unkosher. Now, this is a very important halachic ruling. Because you have to understand, first of all, that it's safe to assume that one out of X number of cows has perforations in its lungs. One out of 80, one out of 90, whatever it might be. You have to understand that if a cow is rendered unkosher, it's a fortune of money. A cow in Israel today costs upwards of $2,000 to $3,000. It's a lot of money. There's a tremendous amount of meat that comes out of a cow. And so you're wasting a tremendous amount of food if you're doing this, or having a lot more food. And you also have to understand that the process of checking these lungs raises the cost of meat production, because you have to have a special person who's trained and knows how to do this, and you have to do it carefully, and whatever else it might be. So that's the halachic ruling, but there are some rabbis that take upon themselves to ensure that the meat is actually glatt, that it's been checked, etc. Right? And that's a chumrah. It's a stringency. It's a very valuable stringency. For a long time I keep glatt in my house, so that anybody wants to come eat in my house can eat in my house, but I don't keep glatt out of the house. I happen to feel, you know, based on poskim that I've seen, etc., and piskei halacha that I've received, that I don't think that that you have to keep glatt. I think I actually read a tremendous, tremendous responsum. One of the problems with glatt kosher meat is that it raises the price of meat incredibly, and that alone is enough of a reason not to keep glatt. So that's an interesting question. And there are a lot of sources for that. And if you go to buy a little thing of chopped liver that's glatt, you'll see it's about three times the price. So, okay. Anyway, that being the case, you will find kosher and glatt kosher. I remember when I first came to Israel, they came up with this thing called Mahadrin. Now Mahadrin is very interesting, because Mahadrin refers not to the level of kashrut. It refers actually to the level of the people who are checking the kashrut. And it said that we have a certain level, and we have a very stringent group, right? A court which sits and oversees all of these individuals, and there is some legitimacy to this, right? And therefore, this is Mahadrin. The word Hidur means beautification. For example, a beautiful etrog is called Hidur, right? Hanukkah, lighting more candles, 8 on the 8th day instead of just 1, which is the initial mitzvah, is a Hidur that we all accept traditionally. And therefore, there's Mahadrin. Then at a certain point, I saw that they came up with Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. So I thought, what's Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin? So I think, this is my opinion, that somewhere someone got very smart, and he figured that if he wrote on his store, especially in certain communities, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, everybody would come to his store, and he was right. So now you find Mahadrin, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin doesn't really refer to a different system, it's just, this is incredible, except with one detail, but whatever. Then a few years ago, I was walking through Mea Shearim and I saw a restaurant and it said, Super Mahadrin Min Mahadrin. Christ knows what Super Mahadrin Min Mahadrin is. So let's say you have Super Mahadrin Min Mahadrin Glot and my mother too meat. I mean, if you ever go, I've been on airlines and they always ask you kosher meat or glatt kosher meat. So I figure, you know, it's not costing me anything, they've got the meal. So I get glatt kosher meat, whatever it is. And I've seen that you can get glatt kosher Deer Park water. It says glatt kosher on the water, which is absurd. Chicken, by the way, also can't be glatt, because the lungs of a chicken don't have this issue, right? You can't have glatt kosher lasagna. It doesn't work, right? So that's just so you know. Next time you're on a plane and somebody's eating a glatt kosher vegetable, you know, you could say, oh, actually, the Magen Avraham, okay. Anyway, right? Say, well, you know, I don't want to go into it. It's a whole class. You have to come to Israel. Anyway, right? So let's say I have super kosher meat. And I have super kosher milk. You know, there's a halacha in milk known as Chalav Yisrael. Chalav Yisrael. Milk which was supervised throughout the entire milking process by a Jew. And this was a very legitimate, a very difficult question in the time of the Talmud, because non-Jews would use milk in their ceremonies for idolatry, and even more prevalent, pig milk was a lot cheaper than cow milk, so they would switch cow milk with pig milk. So in order to avoid this problem, the halacha was that if you wanted to drink milk, you had to drink milk that was supervised or milked by a Jew. Okay. In the 50s, in America, and even the 40s, with the advent of, you know, the FDA and all sorts of regulatory agencies which oversee these types of issues. So many rabbis ruled in America and in England and later in more Western countries that the financial loss that a company would incur if it was discovered that they were using pig milk instead of regular milk was so great that we can now assume halachically that all milk is kosher, and therefore you don't have to have milk that's milked by a Jew, and I in fact drink regular milk, right? In Israel, all the milk is Chalav Yisrael, just about, because we're all Jews. Or at least all the Jews, there are some Jews in every dairy company, it's safe to assume. So you can assume that it's all Chalav Yisrael. Okay. But let's say I decide, you know, in certain communities, they still, either because they believe that it's a halacha which stands, or by virtue of the fact that once you have a halacha, you shouldn't do away with it for other reasons. So there are certain communities, in America, they're very stringent about Chalav Yisrael. In fact, they tell a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein, who was one of the greatest rabbis of the last generation, when Moshe Feinstein was sitting at a brunch, and it was like one of these like breakfast, you know, kind of get together for breakfast brunches, and they had, you know, a couple of milk cartons there, and each of them was a different, you know, you get those little like 25-cent, you know, little tiny milk cartons that when you were a kid, you know, you would drink and whatever and throw away or have milk fights with or whatever, right? So they had a couple of these sitting on the table. And he picks up one and he looks at it, and he puts it there, and he picks up the other one and looks at it, and just, you know, and he drinks the second one. Now, Moshe Feinstein was one of the Gedolei Hador, he was one of the greats of the generation. And a person reaches that stature when everybody watches everything they do. You can learn as much from watching such a person as you can from actually learning Torah from them. Because they are living Torah. So the word spread like wildfire. And afterwards, someone ran up to see which of the milks Rav Moshe didn't drink. And there were two different rabbinic certifications, and the word spread that there was one rabbinic certification that Rav Moshe preferred. Anyway, within a week, this guy was going out of business. Because in Borough Park and in Brooklyn and those communities, you know, that's it. I mean, Rav Moshe's word. And everybody drinks Chalav Yisrael. So this guy frantically calls up Rav Moshe Feinstein and arranges for an appointment and comes in and says, what's wrong with my milk? The guy who owns the dairy farms. Rav Moshe says, what are you talking about? He says, listen, I checked everything. I checked the farms. I checked the supervision. I checked the milkers. I checked everything I could check. Why are you unhappy with my rabbinic certification? Everybody says, what are you talking about? I don't have a problem with the rabbinic certification. As far as I'm concerned, it's fine. Turns out that he was sitting at the brunch, and he picked up one, and the date was expired, and he put it down, and he picked up the other, and he said it was fine, so he drank it. So people came a little overboard. But I've got super kosher milk and super kosher meat. Why can't I put them together? I mean, if it's kosher, it's kosher. I mean, didn't your mom tell you that it all gets mixed up inside anyway? So what's going on? These are my basic questions with regards to kashrut. How can something be inherently kosher or unkosher? Why are the signs that the Torah gives somehow to help me become a better person? And why is it that in some instances, kosher objects become unkosher simply by being mixed with other kosher objects? Okay. Now, having said this, all right, Now we can get into analyzing the issues of kashrut. And I want to tell you that we'll take a look first, and I don't normally do this, at the mystical perspective. And we discussed a little bit what that means, the mystical perspective, but I'll allude to it as we go along. You know, there are different categories of life in Judaism. I've mentioned this. There are four levels, you know, within the Jewish system. Kabbalah, mysticism describes this a great deal. That there are four different levels of creation, right? There is domeim, the inanimate object, right? A rock, for example, which has no life, and yet it's a created object. Then I have tzomeach, things that grow, which is a higher form of life. They react to the world around them, they change, they grow, and they die. And therefore they more resemble life as we know it, ourselves, God, etc. Then there is chai, the animal world, which is a much higher life form than the plant world. And then there's Adam, human beings. And there are four different levels of life. And it's interesting that there are certain things which separate these levels of life, right? For example, the difference, obviously, between tzomeach, the plant kingdom, and the animal kingdom, is the level of action on the part of the animal kingdom. Animals have a level of instinct that plants don't possess, right? And the animal lives in the world of instinct. What separates human from animal is that a human being has the capability of rising above his instinct. For example, you'll never see a hyena. How does a hyena eat, right? A hyena is not an animal of the hunt. It's an animal of prey, but not of the hunt. A hyena, jackals, feed off other animals' hunt. And they follow the hunting patterns of other animals. So that if a lion will kill a deer, the lion will only eat the best parts of the deer. Right? He's the king. He's not going to waste his time on the entrails. And he leaves a lot of it. First of all, because the lion knows it can get another deer. And second of all, because the lion is the lion. Right? So it leaves part of the deer. Comes along the hyena. The ecosystem in the world is an incredible thing. And the hyena eats exactly what the lion doesn't eat. So the hyena will sit around the animal's hunt and wait until the lion is gone. No hyena is dumb enough to try to eat the other part. You know, you never saw a hyena come down to the lion and say, listen, I'm only eating this part, so you keep eating, you know. But afterwards, the hyenas will come down and they'll prey on the carcass of the lion's hunt. You'll never see a hyena sit at the edge of the hunt and say, you know what? I need to work on myself. Today, I'm going to fast. I'm not going to eat because I want to elevate myself, right? Hyena has an instinct, and that instinct is to eat. And when a hyena has food, it will eat. And there's nothing the hyena can do to choose not to eat. Because its instinct rules it. That's the definition of an animal. If an animal has to, whatever, perform all sorts of bodily functions, it can do them. As a matter of fact, the reason that Kabbalah says that there are different levels within the animal world is whether or not I can change an animal's instincts. For example, I can train an animal not to, let's say, urinate inside the house. That's an unbelievable thing. Because the instinct of an animal is that if an animal wants to relieve itself, so it relieves itself. How do I train an animal not to relieve itself in my house? I don't teach it to deny its instinct. I don't teach it to elevate itself above its instinct. I teach it to change its instinct. Either through positive or through negative or both stimuli. So the animal has an instinct to urinate, and the animal also has an instinct not to get kicked in the head, God forbid. So, in order to avoid instinct number two, it conquers instinct number one, and it changes its instinct pattern. So I get a rat to run through a maze. A human being, however, doesn't change his instincts. A human being has a capability of rising above his instinct. I have the instinct to sleep. I'm tired. I want to sleep. I choose not to sleep for a higher ideal. I have the instinct to eat. Right? People make a mistake. They think on Yom Kippur, I'm supposed to reach a level of purity where I don't want to fast. I don't think that's true. I mean, if you look at the end of Yom Kippur, there's a very special instinct that develops in Jews all over the world. Right? I don't know if you've ever seen this. It's a bodily instinct. Right? You know? Right about an hour before the fast. They just start to look sort of at their wrists very strangely. And what is everybody thinking of in the middle of Ne'ilah, in the middle of this prayer? Right? I mean, this is the struggle that's going on mentally. You know, so you're thinking of God and the high priest and whatever, and it's incredible, and the high service, and repentance, and bagels. How'd that get in there? Wait a second. No, get out. Okay. And the high priest and the temple and whatever and hot dogs. And that's the challenge. And it's there. And people think, oh my God, I've blown it. I'm thinking about hot dogs. I don't think that's true. I think the opposite is true. I think the fact that I'm thinking of the hot dog and that I want the hot dog and when I'm thinking of the hot dog, I got mustard and sauerkraut and a big bun and it's gesunder. And I'm saying to God, look how much I want this hot dog and look how much I'm willing not to eat it because I love you. It's a whole different perception. So that's the difference between man and animal, right? That you can rise above your instinct. And really, this leads us to another question. There are two parts to the human existence. There is the physical, and there is the spiritual. There is the mind, and there is the matter. And we spoke about this the other day. And the ultimate question is, who rules who? Does the physical rule the spiritual? Or does the spiritual rule the physical? Am I leading the animal within me by a leash? Or is the animal within me dragging me along back to the jungle? That's the ultimate question. And that will very much relate to how these two affect each other and to our understanding of kashrut. Now, why is that? So we have to go into one more detail in order to understand this. So check this out. This is a mind-boggling thing. This is just magnificent. Look in Genesis. Open up the book of Genesis to the first chapter of Genesis. And I want to tell you, by the way, that this chapter is an exact example. In other words, Rabbi Cordoza saved me a good 10, 15 minutes of discussion because what he said last night, Nero Yair, exactly will fit into what we're talking about. So I have to give you 2 minutes of what Rabbi Cordoza said just so. Rabbi Cordoza was discussing the question of why I'm summarizing. So anyway, it's a good thing if you heard the lecture to hear a summary in 2, 3, 4 minutes. That's a good thing anyway. And you should be able to do this, by the way. You ever want to test whether you got something out of a lecture? Okay? Try to give it over to somebody else. If you can summarize an hour lecture in 5 minutes, you know you've got it. If you can't, then it means you have to go back to your notes. If you didn't take your take notes or try to remember it, so then that's a different question. That just means you're silly. But anyway, right? But I mean, Cardoza basically said, you know, there's certain halachot, there's certain laws which seem to be basic in principle to Judaism, and yet they're not found at the beginning of the Torah, when the Torah is given, and such an example is kashrut. From there he got to the question of the sin of the golden calf. There is a very famous debate between Rashi and the Ramban as to whether or not the tabernacle, the mitzvah of the tabernacle, of having a mishkan, was given to us as a result of the sin of the golden calf. The Ramban says that can't be. The tabernacle and its successor, the temple, and all of that is so essential to Judaism, and it's one of the basic spiritual pinnacles and mystical pinnacles of Judaism. But Rashi, and those who follow Rashi, seem to say, no, in fact, the tabernacle is a result of the sin of the golden calf. And because the sin of the golden calf led to the tabernacle, that means that essentially the ideal was that we wouldn't have needed a tabernacle. And in fact, we wouldn't have needed a temple. And further said Rabbi Cardozzi, he quoted the Sfarno. Sfarno was an Italian commentator, 16th century, who says essentially that in fact the entire concept of the Mishkan and the temple would not have existed were it not for the sin of the golden calf. So that ultimately Judaism changes drastically by virtue of the fact that we messed up and we sinned at the golden calf. If this is true, then I have to understand what the sin of the golden calf was. Says Rabbi Cardozzi, based on the Sfarno, that essentially, the sin of the golden calf was not despite the revelation at Sinai, but because of it. Because we reached such an intense level, speaking and hearing directly from God, able somehow to see sound, the challenge was not to experience it, but how to hang on to it. How does one maintain such a spiritual level? And the Jews were making an attempt to find some tangible expression that would serve to remind them, to constantly keep them connected to that incredible experience of Sinai. And that is what we call the sin of the golden calf. And he pointed out that the golden calf is not necessarily a golden calf, it's an egel hazahav. And by the way, I would just add, he didn't mention this, but the mystics discuss the word egel as related to igul, a circle. The circle is considered the perfect shape, complete harmony, total perfection. And that very much resembles the concept of God. And gold, which is found in many, many instances, including, by the way, the vision of Ezekiel, his vision of what God looked like somehow, right? So gold very much is the perfection of the material world. And the combination of those two is what the Jewish people were trying to establish and trying to remain connected to. And hopefully they would be able to take this golden calf, we'll call it, wherever they went, and this would remind them and reestablish their connection with God so that they would never lose that sensitivity to a direct relationship with God. The problem was that a human being is not capable of doing this. And it's interesting to note that God, in fact, in the tabernacle, does exactly that. He gives the Jewish people back their golden calf. The whole tabernacle is full of gold, and the example par excellence is that in the Holy of Holies, on top of the Aron itself, there were in fact two Kruvim golden angels, and this is God's golden calf. And therefore, what God responds to the Jewish people is that while this may be a good idea, it's a disaster if you try to do it. Because you are not capable of creating a tangible expression of the abstract me with a capital M. But I, says Rabbi Yehuda Levi in explaining this difference, I am. And therefore, the Jewish people post-golden calf were in a different state. And they had to be given a different system. And the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, are a function of the fact that we need some focus to reestablish that relationship with God. And in fact, Rabbi Cardoza used this, as does the Chovot HaLevavot, Rabbi Nobachi Ibn Pekudei, to explain why Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were never given the Torah. Because Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were on a level that they didn't need the Torah. They had that direct relationship with God. They were capable of having a relationship with God in the abstract. They didn't need the tangible, the material, the idea, which was reflected by this need to react to the Chet HaEgel, to the sin of the golden calf. After the Jewish people were in Egypt, so then they needed a different level, and in fact they were given the Torah, because they'd sunk, and they'd been affected by their environment, and therefore they were given the Torah. After the golden calf, they were given the temple. Suggests Rabbi Cardoza, based actually on the Sfarno, and the Chovot HaLevavot, Rabbeinu Bach Ibn Pekudei, right? That kashrut, in fact, was given much later in the Torah, because up until that point, the Jewish people didn't need kashrut. And kashrut also somehow is a reaction to this need on the part of the Jewish people to make the abstract somewhat more tangible, a demonstration of the fact that the Jewish people were not capable of living on the level that they had achieved at Sinai. And kashrut comes along partly to remedy this situation. Now, this is 5 minutes on a 2-hour lecture, so I recognize that you've got a taste, but you know, and also add to that the fact that you're hearing it from me instead of Rabbi Cardoza, so if this raises issues, please take them up with Rabbi Cardoza. Why do I tell you all this? Because one of the points that Rabbi Cardoza made was that it seems that after the sin of the golden calf, we'll call the Jewish people Jewishly, spiritually sick. They needed a different diet. If you get sick, you need a diet. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they didn't need that diet. So now I'm going to give you an example, back to where we were, of how this works. Look at the end of Genesis verse 1. And if you weren't sure exactly what I'm talking about because you weren't at the lecture, it'll become more apparent as we go along. Look at chapter 1 in Genesis. Verse 29. When God creates man and woman, he says to them an incredible thing. Vayomer Elohim, and God says, Hinei natati lachem et kol esev. I have given you all the grasses of the field, zorea zera, seed producing. Asher al panei kol haaretz. This is on page 2 at the top, right, verse 29. Yet kol haetz asher bo priyetz zorea zera, and all the fruit producing trees lachem yela ochla. These will be for you to eat. In other words, you can eat any vegetable, any fruit from any tree from the field that you want. Ulachol chayat haaretz. To all the animals, ulechol ofashamayim, and to all the birds, ulechol romesal aretz, all the creepy crawly things, asher bo nefesh chaya, that have a living soul. In other words, the animal kingdom as opposed to the plant kingdom, the chai as opposed to the tzomeach. Et kol yerek esiv lochla, all vegetables you can eat. That's a very strange sentence. Do you see that? But all the animals. The vegetables I give you to eat. So it's almost like God got distracted. Like God is giving a schmooze, and he just kind of loses his thought process. But that obviously doesn't work if you accept our perception of God. So what is God saying? He's saying, this isn't even something you should consider. This is out of bounds. So in fact, humanity was told to keep kosher. They were told that you can't eat meat. They were supposed to be vegetarians. And this is what our tradition tells us. That the human beings, ideally, were supposed to be vegetarians. As a matter of fact, Rav Kook discusses this, and we'll get to an understanding of why. And Rav Kook was a vegetarian. He only ate meat on Shabbat because our system equates simcha, joy, with eating meat. I can personally very much relate to this issue. And therefore, on Shabbat, you're supposed to eat meat. That's an interesting dilemma for a vegetarian. But ideally, we should be vegetarians. And in fact, when the temple is reintroduced, we will all become vegetarians, according to Rav Kook, and possibly even according to the Rambam. So there's some value to being a vegetarian. And that's what we were told, be a vegetarian. Now look at chapter 9. Chapter 9 is an unbelievable thing. Because God in chapter 9 changes his mind. This is unbelievable. How does God change his mind? So look at chapter 9, verse, you know, when Noah and the family and all the animals got out of the ark, so God gives them what? What's the biggest gift or responsibility that God gives Noah after the flood? Pardon? Well, that's only one small detail. Pardon?
To replenish the earth.
To replenish the earth, okay, you know. I'll give you a hint, the number I'm looking for. The seven Noahide laws. God says, you now have a system of laws. He never does this with Adam. All he tells Adam is don't eat from the tree. Adam messes it up, fine. But he doesn't come back and say, okay. You know, humanity, when you think about it, doesn't have to do anything. They're fine. There's no law. Now comes along after the flood and God says to Noah, you got to keep law. And you have seven laws. Don't adulter, don't steal, don't murder, right? Don't eat limbs from living animals. Don't testify falsely. Create a system of judges, and don't idolater. Seven laws. So, I don't get it. I mean, did you ever wonder about that? If God's so brilliant, I remember when I taught first grade. One year I decided I'm going to teach first grade. I wanted to see what it was like to teach different classes, so I taught first grade. It was a harrowing experience, and I used to come home from the day absolutely exhausted, but I had a lot of fun. One of the most important things in teaching is to establish for yourself goals. I walk into this classroom and I have certain goals. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes I don't, but I have goals. What was my goal for teaching first grade? I thought, you know, these kids, they came to first grade and they loved it. They loved school. You ever see a little kid who's off to first grade with his new backpack and pencil set, right? It's a little excited. I remember my daughter went to first grade. She was so excited to go to first grade, right? So I thought, what if they would actually be just as excited to go to second grade? Like somewhere along the line, someone comes along and messes it all up. Because by the time you meet these kids in seventh grade, they hate going to school. And they're ecstatic at the opportunity not to go to school. So I thought, what if school could be so great that they actually want to go to second grade? So that was my goal. So puppets and guitars and stories. And we covered the entire book of Joshua and Judges that year with these first graders. Went through all the stories. Read it inside. They learned a lot of it. But we did it like, you know, you can imagine. I remember when we got to the story of David and Goliath. So I figured out what the actual meterage measurement of Goliath would have been according to the, you know, the biggest measurement that a cubit would be. It was like 9 feet, something like that. So I measured it and I actually made a life-size like drawing on paper of Goliath and we pasted it up on the wall. We took this little, like the shortest kid in the class, put him up and said, fight Goliath. So they're like, oh, you know, it was great, right? I ran into some of them later in like fourth grade. Someone had messed them up, you know. But I remember the first couple months, yeah, they hated school already. I remember the first couple months. So it was great and I had a good time, but they ran all over me. And it never hit me until one day it happened that the principal just, you know, sort of was making his rounds and he came into the classroom. And they were all screaming and yelling and having fun and I'm asking questions and some are answering and some are not and a couple of paper airplanes and, you know, it wasn't like way out of control, but, you know. And the principal walks into the room. He looks in and he sees, like, you know, there's a few kids off in the corner and, you know, they're running around and somebody wants to answer a question and I'm not answering. So he jumps out of his chair and comes over to me and pulls my sleeve, whatever. And the principal opens the door. He didn't even walk in. The principal opened the door. One of the kids sees, these are first graders. They've only been in school for a year. The whole room, you could have heard a pin drop. Every kid who was out of their chair ran to their seat and sat there like this. Okay? 32 first graders. I was just, my mouth dropped open. And I see the principal standing there, and he steps inside. Every single one of these kids got up. 32 first grade kids, boys and girls, got up. Get up, what are you kidding me? I walk into the room, I mean, they're all over me. This blew me away. So I said, okay, I gotta go talk to this guy. So I went to talk to him. And I slowly learned how he did this. And I realized you have to have a system, you have to draw lines, you have to have an edge, right? Well, this would seem to be what's going on here, except that there's one problem. See, with me, you could say, okay, I made certain mistakes. And I remember he was saying, you know, the big difficulty, is that you now have to correct mistakes you've made. He says, what I do isn't difficult, because I came into it from day one. And now, you know, later I knew if I would teach little kids, so you have to establish certain rules right at the beginning. I know a guy, he takes this to an extreme. The first week of class, he teaches fourth grade kids. The first week of school, he doesn't teach them a thing. He teaches them to sit in their chair, put their pencil down, put their notebook down. And he knows this, the whole first week, right? He comes in, he says, I want everybody to be sitting in their chair with a notebook just like this, and a pencil next to it, and a pen, and a ruler, and your books in your desk. And when I come in, you stand up. And when I sit down, you sit down. And when I say good morning, you all say good morning. And then we can start class. And then he plays this game with him. He comes in and he looks around the room and he sees one person's notebook isn't there. Right? So he says to everybody, get up, walk out, come back in, put your notebook, put all your stuff back in your bag. And they do this. They get up, they take all their bags, they come outside, they come back in. So the first couple of times it's cute. By the 30th time, it's like ridiculous. They're getting very annoyed. Right? And he comes in and one kid doesn't get up. So he says, okay, everybody get out, come back in, I'm gonna come in, and they do this again. And it drives them nuts. So by the end of the week, they can't stand him, but they finally get the point and they do it. And then he gradually loosens up. But he's got him. Now I'm not saying whether I would do that, I certainly wouldn't try it, this is right, but you understand. So my problem was that I never thought of this. I never thought this through. But God? I mean, God thinks this through. What, God didn't realize he needed laws? What do you mean? Hello? Adultery? Good idea. Why didn't you tell Adam not to do it? Or at least his children? So how can you blame man and understand something? Why is God giving Noah these laws? Because it didn't work. They need laws. How didn't it work? Well, I guess everybody abused these laws. And when they abused these laws, vatimaleh haaretz chamas, the land was filled with violence and theft and everything else, right? And it didn't work, so God has destroyed the whole world. Nebuch! 3 million people are dead. Why? Because God forgot to tell them not to murder. How could you blame them? Unless you understand the point that Rabbi Kadosh was making last night. The ideal was that man shouldn't need the laws. The ideal was that man should be on a level that I don't need such a system, that I have such a direct relationship with God that I shouldn't require this. The Mishnah says an unbelievable thing. Dash lo shad varim ve'ena tabali de'avera. If you will know three things, you will not come to sin. Da malamala mimcha, know what's above you. Ayin ro'ah, ozen shomat, there is a eye that watches, right? An ear that hears. The lifnei mi atabali tein din v'cheshbon, and before whom ultimately you will be giving an accounting. Because the traditional perception is that we are all going to have to give an accounting. That if there's a God, and if there's a this world, and there's a next world, whatever that means, and if this world has meaning, it means that we're responsible for what we do. And we have to give an accounting at some point, whatever that means. It's not so easy, you know, it's not like there's scales and there's a court. We don't know what it means, but whatever it means. If you knew that God was sitting right here, right now, then you wouldn't have a problem. You couldn't sin if God was watching you. Right? You can't sit at the table with the principal and cheat. You're not an idiot. It's because we sort of don't realize that God is everywhere. Ein od milvado, that there is nothing but God, because we delude ourselves in that perception, all of us, that we are able to make mistakes. So the original goal was that man and God should have such a relationship that they would be there. What did I call that in the Bible? The Garden of Eden. Okay, so they got out of the Garden of Eden, but you could still have an incredible relationship, so I still shouldn't need laws. Comes along the flood. It's not going to work. So now we have to have a system. And there are different stages in this system that Rabbi Kadoza, that the Sfarno was describing. There is the stage of the Garden of Eden. Things change a little bit. And then there is the stage of the flood. And then there's the stage of Egypt, the Jewish people being in Egypt, so we need the Torah. And then there's the stage of the golden calf, and there are even other stages beyond that. And certain stages in history force me to adapt the system. It's an incredible idea. So having said all this, now let's look at one of the things that God tells Noah and the sons of Noah. Look at this verse. This is a mind-boggling verse. Chapter 9, verse 3. And listen to how this is almost the same language. Kol remes asher hu chai, all living things, lachem yiyeh le'ochla, will be for you to eat. Keyerek esev natati lechem et kol, just as the vegetable world have I given you all this. In other words, the Torah is purposely reminding me, right, of the verse that I originally quoted you in chapter 1, right? Hine natati lechem et kol esev. I've given you all the grasses of the field, and now God says, just like Kiyarek Esav, I gave you then, now you can eat all animals. So this also raises an interesting question, unless I understand the point that was made. How could God change his mind? But of course God changes his mind. Man changes. And the new man, post-flood, needs this system. Now why do I tell you all this? Because this is a fascinating thought. What this tells me, right, is that there was some spiritual problem, agreed? There was some problem in the spiritual relationship between man and God, the result of which was the flood. So what would I expect? Now hear me well. What would I expect God to do? I would expect God to say, I want everybody in synagogue. I want Torah study. No. He says, from now on, eat hamburgers. What does hamburger eating have to do with my spiritual level? Apparently the Torah seems to feel, and you know, remember my original perspective. This is what God is telling me, so I have to figure it out. And by the way, if the Torah is written by God, again, my perspective, and if God created me, again, my perspective, then God has to know what I need. So God's telling me that if I want to affect my spiritual level, I can affect the spirit within me by the physical that I put into me. That's an unbelievable thing. Somehow, eating meat is going to affect me spiritually. And the rabbis discuss this in different ways. Some of them look at it as a question of passion. Man had unbridled passion. And that passion caused man to stray. And comes along God and says, rather than take out those energies on other human beings, if you have those energies, respect them. Judaism doesn't deny the animal within me, but rather tries to harness it, respect it. Better to kill animals than to kill human beings. I've got to tell you, that's never been enough for me. It's always bothered me. First of all, if that's true, there should be some reflection of the fact that it's then wrong to eat animals. And even kashrut should be presented not as an ideal, but as a problem. And it's not, really. Unless, of course, you follow this perception to its conclusion. But it's interesting to note that there is a relationship. Now, what does this mean? And by the way, you see this in a number of places. I'll give you a great example. In Deuteronomy, in chapter 12, verse 22, Yud Bet Chaf Bet, there's a very powerful verse. There is a very specific food item, which is inherently forbidden, even from a kosher animal, that every animal has. What is that? No, interestingly enough, you can eat brain. Whether you want to eat brain, that's an interesting thing, but you can eat brain. Yeah. Matter of fact, there are certain Sephardic circles that eat brains and believe it makes you smart. I don't know if I would want to eat a cow's brains, but okay, right? Yeah? Blood. Blood I can't eat. Not only can't I eat, but there's a whole system of halacha known as melicha, salting, to remove all traces of blood from the animal. Why? So the Torah actually tells me why I don't eat blood, which is very fascinating, because kashrut is generally perceived as something that the reasons for which are not given. In Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 22, the Torah tells me, Ki dam hu anefesh, because blood is the soul. Now, blood's a physical thing. Nefesh is a spiritual thing, maybe. So how does that relate to each other? Somehow, eating blood affects me spiritually. So now listen. Remember I told you that the ultimate question is the body the instrument of the soul, or does the body lead the soul towards the physical world? If there are two parts to my existence, and the body is the conduit between the physical world and the spiritual within, and if the body therefore can be the instrument that my soul uses to come closer to God, right? If all of the concept, think about this logically for a moment, if the entire concept of mitzvot is that by doing mitzvot, I somehow elevate my spiritual level and come closer to God, then it has to be that the physical world around me is the tool through which I become spiritual. It has to be. Otherwise the entire system of Torah, and by the way, in general religious systems, would make no sense. It has to be that I can glean from the physical around me spirituality. Otherwise, Torah and all of Torah. I take tefillin and I put it on my arm. Well, what is that? Physical affects the spiritual. I drink wine on Shabbat. What is that? Physical affects the spiritual. So say the rabbis, and this is really Rekanati, a Kabbalist, 14th century in Tamei HaMitzvot, I believe. Tremendous idea. The more passive that the body is, the more it will yield, this is a mystical idea, to the dictates of the soul. In other words, inasmuch as I involve my body in my spiritual pursuits, the more passive my body becomes, the more I'm able to concentrate on the pursuits of my soul. And conversely, the more that the body becomes active, the more it will distract and arouse the animal instinct in man. And this is really fascinating. This has a lot to do with the concept of Avodat Hashem, the service of God. Because part of the dual goal that I have in becoming active in the world is to become passive before God. That I should literally see myself as subservient before the desire of God. Even though my activity is in and of itself part and parcel of that subservience. If I understand that it's not my will that's paramount, but God's, and if I choose to believe and understand, and this is what I believe tradition wants, that God wants me somehow to be active in a partnership with God, the very activity that I demonstrate is really my passivity before the will of God. So what distracts me from that active, passive perception? Well, we have two parts. The animal and the human. The spiritual and the physical. That which strives to be like unto God, and that which pulls us away from God. And if we call the part that pulls us away from God the instincts, the desires, those things which arouse in us animal passion, then finding a way to harness that energy in the service of God, to subjugate the animal to the spiritual within me, is ultimately a part of our goal. Now I have to point out something very important here. And this is perhaps one of the ideas that separates Judaism from many other religious ideas, in as much as I've seen, I'm not an expert, classical Christianity being a good example. Clearly Judaism doesn't believe that the ideal is to ignore the animal within us. That's clear. It may be that sometimes temporarily, in order to find the middle path, you should deny the animal within you in order to more appreciate its potency. But ultimately, the challenge is not to deny, but to harness the animal within me. There's a beautiful Talmudic discussion It says, if a person has a passion to kill, to be a murderer, he should become a ritual slaughterer, a shochet. Fascinating idea. And the Talmud goes on and gives a few more examples. If a person has a desire to steal, he should collect money for tzedakah, for charity. Now, I've always found this a little strange. I don't know if I would want to give my charity to such a person, but I guess what the Talmud is saying is sometimes a person doesn't need the money. You know, I once saw this magnificent program on shoplifting. It was like one of these, like, Discovery Channel, you know, PBS, whatever. And, you know, they had one of these closed-circuit security cameras, and this girl had agreed, it was a real story, and the girl had agreed to participate in this video as a part of her community service, which she, you know, as part of her court sentence. So this was a real story. It was a real person. You met her parents. It was unbelievable. This girl was in a store, and she was going around this big department store, and when nobody thought she was looking, she took something insignificant. It was like a brush or a comb or something, and slipped it in her pocket. And as she's walking out the door, right, so the security guard walks after her into the parking lot, because apparently she has to leave the store before you can prove that she shoplifted, right? And he grabs her and he says, you'll have to come with me. And she starts protesting, what are you talking about? And he says, you'll have to come with me. And he brings her in and brings her upstairs into the security office. And in front of another witness, he reaches into her pocket and pulls out this item and says, you know, did you pay for this? Can you show me your receipt? And she's like, oh, you know, I didn't realize. I totally forgot. I whatever. Anyway, they prosecute her. And they say to her, you know, watch. And they rewind the tape and they show her the tape, right? And it shows her looking around and putting the thing in her pocket, right? So she can't deny it. So she starts to cry. I'm so sorry. I'll pay for it. I'll pay double. I really feel terrible. You're right. I won't do it again. Whatever. I'm sorry. You know, we have to prosecute you because we have to discourage other shoplifters. So they take her to jail. And she gets put in jail. And then she has to arrange bail. She doesn't have enough money on her. So she has to call her parents. And the parents have to come and bail her out of jail. And you can imagine the scene. And towards the end, they take you to this family's home. And they're sitting and talking with the parents. Why do you think your daughter shoplifted? And you go into this home, and I want you to know, it's mind-boggling. What a home. What a house. And maybe that's why they chose this girl for this videotape. It was unbelievable. Multi-million dollar house. Multi-million, they show like four cars parked in front. And there are a couple of servants. And magnificent living room they're sitting in. And they focus on a painting. And you know how like you make innocuous conversation before you get to the point, you know. Where is that painting? Well, actually, that painting was just on loan to such and such a museum. And this girl shoplifting a comb, give out! So sometimes you have a need to take what isn't yours. So, great! So what would I expect? Fight it! Go up on the mountain and just look at your feet all day! And don't eat, and don't drink, and don't sleep, and deny! No, says Judaism. That's great! Because that's what God gave you, and that's a part of who you are! But what are you gonna do with it? Are you going to turn it to theft? Or are you going to use it to collect tzedakah? If you have a need to have money go through your fingertips, go out and become a fundraiser. Raise money for orphans. And if you have a need to shed blood, sometimes blood needs to be shed, unfortunately. But can you find a positive way to do it? Not an easy thing. Don't deny the animal within you. Channel it. Harness it. Make use of it. Put it to the service of the world and of God and of a better place. And that's part and parcel of kashrut. The challenge is, can I harness the animal nature within me to the service of a higher ideal? And it's interesting to note, therefore, that there seems to be some leaning towards the vegetative state. Towards the vegetable. It's interesting. I told you. There are no vegetables that are inherently unkosher. I may have unkosher vegetables or fruit based on a process that I can do. If I haven't given charity in my fields, that makes sense. But that doesn't mean the vegetables are inherently unkosher. Not so with the animal kingdom. Says the mystical perception, tremendous idea. Examine what this is. It's interesting to note that every animal that's kosher is a herbivore. If you are going to be forced to take into you a part of that animal world, at least reduce the animal nature even of that animal. Because the question ultimately is not, what is an unkosher object? The question is, what does that object do to me? Do I recognize that the physical world affects me? It's a very dangerous thing to deny the physical world, and it's a very dangerous thing to deny the impact that the physical world has on me as a human being. How much I'm affected by my environment. Sitting in a car, listening to a tape that says, do me, baby. I mean, does that affect you? No, I'm just music. Or does it really affect you? So maybe that's an extreme. Sitting at a table and listening to people speak foul language, listening to people slander. Don't think, says Halakha, that just because you're not speaking slander, it doesn't affect you. You're hearing slander, it's going into your mind. And you're affected. Very much. And says the mystical perception of Kashrut, you are affected by what you eat. And therefore it's interesting to note that all of the animals, the more that food takes man, there's a, by the way, a brilliant article written by Diane Grunfeld. It's the Introduction to the Dietary Laws, a two-volume set that I think is somewhere on the shelves, but it's a magnificent book. And he details part of what we're saying here, and he says a magnificent thing. He says, the more that food takes man in a carnal direction, the less sensitive, the more indifferent we are to our soul. I'll read it again. The more food takes man in a carnal direction, the less sensitive and the more indifferent we are to our soul. The more passive the body, the more it yields to the dictates of the soul. If I can somehow respect the animal within me and harness it and make it passive, direct it, then I allow my soul to flourish. It's very interesting. Rav Kook writes an incredible commentary on the Siddur, on the prayer book. It's very difficult. To the best of my knowledge, it's in Hebrew. I've never seen it in English. I don't know if it is or not. I haven't looked into Rav Kook in English. And Rav Kook's language is just beautiful. And it's called Olat HaRiyah. And he has an introduction to prayer. And he says there an unbelievable thing. He says, the soul of man is constantly praying. Because what does it mean that I'm praying? It means that I'm trying to develop my relationship with God. My soul constantly yearns for that relationship with God. So my soul, you know, we think about praying three times a day, once a day. My soul is in prayer right now. But my body, my activity, impedes the ability of my soul to pray. What I do when I choose a period of time to pray is I attempt to remove some of the physical obstacles that will allow my soul to pray and to release the constant spiritual energy that it has. It's a tremendous idea. And that's exactly what's going on here. When I steep myself in the physical world, to a certain extent, I run a risk. Because that physicality, that activity, can almost imbalance the spiritual energy. Unless I direct that physical back into the spiritual world. So vegetables are preferred. And animals that are kosher are herbivores. And it's interesting, by the way, all the animals that are unkosher, just about, and we'll get to the about in a minute, are animals which are hunters. Animals which prey. Take, for example, the bird kingdom. And I don't have a chance to get into all the animals because we'll never stop. In the bird kingdom, there's a very strange halacha with regards to kosher and unkosher birds. The halacha is, the Torah tells me a whole list of specific birds that are kosher and unkosher. And this creates some kind of a problem for us. Why? Because when it comes to animals, so I have a couple of signs. Two signs. A very simple system. Cud chewing, cloven hooves, I know what they are. I can figure out if an animal is kosher or unkosher. And it's interesting, by the way, that the Torah goes so far as to tell me that there are only four animals that have both of these signs, to chew a cud, right? I'm sorry. There are only four animals which have one of these signs. Either they chew their cud, there are three, but don't have cloven hooves, or they have cloven hooves but don't chew their cud. That's what the Torah says. And that's an interesting side point, because for the Torah to make such a claim 3,000 years ago, when you think about it, is an incredible statement. I mean, we've discovered over 50,000 zoological species since then. And they've never discovered another animal which has one or the other and not the other. The camel, the hare, the rabbit, and the pig. So there's a big debate as to what the rabbit is and which one, whatever, but fascinating. Pardon? The camel, the hare, the rabbit, and the pig. Those four animals have either one or the other. Either they chew their cud and don't have cloven hooves, or they have cloven hooves and don't chew their cud. It's a tremendous idea. But what is this? Cloven hoof, chew cud, whatever. So by the birds, we have a very different system. By the birds, the Torah tells me a whole list of specific birds. But of course, I got a problem. Which birds are these? How do I know what an ait is? How do I know what a nesher is? How do I know what a gozal is? It's very difficult. So says the halacha, the system of kashrut by birds is based on tradition. If Jews have a tradition that an animal is kosher or unkosher, that tradition determines that it's kosher or unkosher. Very interesting. There's a respect for tradition in this particular venue that's worth a discussion sometime. And I'll give you a great example. In the countries of the West, the Ashkenazic countries, there was a tradition that a turkey was kosher. Some of the countries in the East, Morocco, for example, Yemen, had a tradition that a turkey was unkosher. So that if you go to Morocco and you want to celebrate Thanksgiving, there's a halachic dilemma. Are you allowed to eat unkosher food in a country where it's viewed unkosher, even though you view it as kosher, because in your country it is kosher? There's only two or three examples of this. But it's a fascinating question. So people have studied why this is. How could it be that an item is kosher or unkosher? We're not sure. What does that mean? So it very much relates to this question. Because all of the birds, for example, the Shulchan Aruch says there are certain signs which we have rabbinically, which can determine an animal. One of them, for example, is Dores V'Ochel. Lidros is to stamp. An animal which uses its claws to kill, to mate, to hunt, is an animal which is unkosher, automatically. Because an animal which displays cruelty, an animal which hunts, an animal which is more carnivorous, active, there's certain birds that are active and sing and they're very involved. Those are the birds that we don't eat. And what are the birds we eat? The more passive birds. Herbivores, same thing. And there's an opinion that I saw that the reason we have different traditions with turkey is because there were different types of turkeys. There were turkeys that actually hunted and there were turkeys that didn't. And so based on this, they developed different traditions, which is a fascinating idea. Chewing the cud, you know what chewing the cud is? Chewing the cud essentially means that an animal has longer, much longer intestines. That it has a much more complex digestive apparatus. That the pursuit of its food is much more passive and self-involved, rather than active, the hunt at the expense of other animals. Says the mystical perception. My choice, God's choice, what God's telling me, is that if you eat from an animal, if you have to eat from an animal, ideally you shouldn't eat from an animal. Because when you eat from an animal, it will affect you. But if you have to eat from an animal, at least eat from an animal that itself has limited its animalistic tendencies. That's a tremendous idea. Now I want you to just know one thing. And by the way, cloven hooves as well. Cloven hooves are hooves which are very unsuitable as weapons. And for the hunt. You know, a pig, for example. So a pig doesn't chew its cud. And that's an interesting question. What a pig is and how a pig works. We won't get to that. But the hoof of a pig, which is cloven, is not used as a weapon. A horse, on the other hand, very much uses its hoof as a weapon. Even though it's a magnificent animal. It says the mystical perception of kashrut, my taking into me that animal violence will somehow mystically affect me. Now, I told you at the beginning when we were discussing the ethical, the symbolic, and the mystical, that when it comes to the mystical, I have this dilemma because I don't feel I'm on a level. I don't know if I'll ever be on a level that I can really fully understand this perception. It's very difficult to understand. It's clear to me that's what the Torah is saying. It's clear to me that somehow this affects me. It's clear to me that there are certain things that we do that affect me spiritually. I've seen too many instances in my life of people who are involved in physical activity and the effect it has on their spiritual level, on their souls, on their persona, and their level of depression, and yet it's not something I can fully understand.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.